Good afternoon, and welcome to the reading of the Waterloo Cedar Falls, The Courier. It's Monday, June 28th. I'm your reader, Bob Young. The Courier is forecasting a shower and thunderstorm today. Winds east-northeast from 4 to 8 miles per hour. We'll have a high of 82 degrees and a low tonight of 68. Again, with showers and thunderstorms possible and very humid weather. Looking around the region, in the regional outlook, cloudy today with a couple of showers and a thunderstorm. Cloudy and humid tonight with a couple of showers and a thunderstorm. A thick cloud cover tomorrow with a thunderstorm. Wednesday, partial sunshine. The next phase of the moon will be last quarter, and that comes on July 1st. The sun rose this morning at 5:35 and sets tonight at 8:51 p.m. Let's check the articles on the front page today. Friends of the family to tackle homelessness. $2 million gift will aid GBPAC facelift. And let's begin with Peace Together, Youth Art Team's Portraits Detail City's Civil Rights History. This story is filed by Andrew Wind and begins with a photograph of patrons in the hallway with large pieces of art hanging on the wall. And the caption says, "A youth art team member and family look at one of the Peace Together portraits last week. The 7 portraits are on display at the Waterloo Center for the Arts until August 31st. Waterloo. The 7 portraits created by the youth art team representing the local civil rights movement take up wide spaces on the walls of Waterloo Center of the Arts, but the unique contribution of each young artist is clear because the collaborative pictures are pieced together with multiple 8x10-inch canvases. At an open house last week, the children, ages 7 to 17, could be seen pointing out their contributions to family members and friends. The project is called Peace Together, and its subjects are people, places, and events in Waterloo's civil rights history during the 1960s and 1970s. 7 teams each created one collaborative portrait in a variety of mediums. The framed portraits tell a larger story about the community and are on display until August 31st. Za Marion Epps, 13, was part of a group of artists that created a portrait of the 1968 Melee at Sloan Wallace Stadium that broke out during an East High School football game and resulted in violence and rioting across downtown. It is based on a photograph that appeared in the Courier. Quote, "The photo was cut up into squares like this and numbered," Epps said, gesturing to the artwork. He worked on several of the pieces in the portrait using acrylic paint, calling the project both fun and frustrating. "But it was interesting to do," he added. "I chose this one because it is actually a pretty important part of equal rights in Waterloo history," said Epps. Artist Araceli Lopez, 14, worked on another portrait, but also first heard about the Sloan Wallace Melee through the project. Quote, "When I learned about it, I was pretty shocked, because I had no idea that riots had happened," she said. Her group completed a portrait of Jimmy Porter, the late founder of KBBG radio station, based on a photo from Iowa PBS. Quote, "I thought he was very inspiring," Lopez said. "This new project puts a face on our freedom story. The 3,000-square-foot mural along the Cedar River of Waterloo's civil rights history, shown abstractly through lines, shapes, and colors. Created in 2019 by 150 young artists, the mural tells stories from the years surrounding 1968, when volunteers started the Junior Art Gallery in the Center for the Arts basement. That was a year of heightened racial tensions locally and nationwide. Quote, "The stories the artists heard as they interviewed community members inspired their artwork and the name they gave their mural," said Heidi Funchman, executive and creative director of Youth Art Team. The same artists worked on Peace Together project starting in fall 2019 and finishing this spring. Youth art team members, as well as participants from Lowell and Kingsley Elementary Schools each recalled stories they heard for the Our Freedom Story mural, chose one subject to focus on, and conducted more community interviews. Lopez said she enjoyed coming to the art gallery and seeing her artwork displayed. Quote, "It makes me remember how much fun I had putting it together," she said. Quote, "It was fun going up to people and trying to find if their artwork connected to yours. And when it all came together, it was amazing," unquote. Other portrait subjects include the 4th Street Bridge, courtesy of Grout Museum of History and Science, Waterloo School sit-in, and Dr. Martin Luther King Jr., with Anna Mae Weems, both courtesy of the Courier, Dr. Walter Cunningham, courtesy of Dr. Walter Cunningham School for Excellence, and Bridgeway Project, courtesy of Waterloo Community Schools. The Piece Together Project was funded, in part, by the Iowa Arts Council, a division of the Iowa Department of Cultural Affairs, the National Endowment for the Arts, Arts Midwest, local family foundations, and individual donors. The nonprofit youth art team relies on individual donations for support. Go online to youthartteam.com/donate for more information. Now a story filed by Kristen Guess, Friends of the Family to Tackle Cedar Valley Homelessness, Waterloo. A local advocacy agency for survivors is embarking on an $800,000 project to end homelessness in the Cedar Valley. Friends of the Family was awarded significant local funding from the Otto Scheutz Foundation to create and facilitate a 6 to 9 month housing program with the goal of eliminating homelessness in Black Hawk County in 5 years. The organization also is working to bring in a matching partner to increase the project to $1.6 million. Quote, "The only way to end homelessness is to get people housed," said Friends of the Family director Ben Brustkern. Quote, "To get people back into housing and moving forward into permanent housing of their own," unquote. The program will work with landlords and organizations in the community to offer housing and services to those in need. The program will offer rent and housing assistance for those who qualify. Friends of the Family already has a rapid rehousing program geared toward victims of violence. The homelessness program will be geared toward the general population. Currently, the organization has about 60 units available for the programs and will be looking for about 90 more. The program offers assistance and services and aims to turn over the household to private housing within 6 to 9 months. They also plan to hire 4 full-time employees, but like many organizations, are struggling to find applicants. Brustkern has been collaborating with other homeless providers in the area as well, including the Salvation Army, Hospitality House, People's Clinic, Black Hawk Grundy Mental Health, and the Jesse Cosby Neighborhood Center. Quote, "It's going to take all of us to reduce it or get to what we call functional zero, where no one is waiting for services," Brustkern said. About 450 people enter the homeless system each year in Black Hawk County, according to Brustkern. Homeless people are added to the system via a statewide coordinated entry where they are placed on a list and pulled off by providers. A majority of them exit within 14 days in Black Hawk County, and about 44% of those are African Americans. Quote, "We know that's a really disproportionate number," he said. Friends of the Family staff also has been working with the city officials to figure out where homeless people are located and having conversations and building relationships with those living on the streets. Quote, "We truly believe in housing first. We don't need to overcome barriers first. We can address them after they're housed. We're going to continue working with them and keep them moving forward," Brustkern said. Friends of the Family began in 1992 in Black Hawk County and has since expanded to aid people in 27 Iowa counties. Those in need are asked to call the Friends of the Family crisis line any day or time at 800-410-7233. For landlords wanting to get involved, go to www.foofia.org/get-involved. Courier staff filed this next story Gallagher Bluedorn receives $12 million gift for renovation and expansion from Barrett Foundation. Cedar Falls, the Pauline R. Barrett Charitable Foundation has given $2 million to the renovation and expansion of the Gallagher Bluedorn Performing Arts Center. Quote, Pauline was known throughout the Cedar Valley for her philanthropy and volunteerism, University of Northern Iowa President Mark Nook said in a news release. The Performing Arts Center is located on UNI's campus. Quote, during her lifetime, the university was fortunate to have her support for student scholarships as well as various capital projects across campus. UNI and Cedar Valley are stronger because of Pauline's transformational support of her community, added Nook. Barrett, a Waterloo resident who died in February 2018, took a great interest in supporting the areas of education, health, and culture. She was a leader in the community through her involvement in numerous community groups and foundations. Quote, the foundation invested in the Gallagher Bluedorn improvements to carry on Pauline's legacy of supporting UNI and the performing arts in the Cedar Valley. The Gallagher Bluedorn is a jewel in the Cedar Valley and one that Pauline was very proud of. Teresa Hoffman, a member of the foundation's grant committee, said in the news release, Pauline was very committed to UNI and its students, and we feel strongly about continuing the work she started, unquote. The 20-year-old Gallagher Bluedorn is slated to undergo a $14.9 million renovation and expansion to modernize the space. Originally built to host 140 events and serve up to 14,000 guests annually, the center currently has nearly 600 events and more than 115,000 guests each year, operating at 10 times its expected capacity. In recognition of the Barrett Foundation's gift, the newly constructed Marquee Lounge will be named the Pauline R. Barrett Charitable Foundation Marquee Lounge. Quote, the Marquee Lounge is the heart of the entire renovation project. The Marquee Lounge will be a world-class gathering place to watch world-class performances that take place on our stage, Steve Kerrigan, executive director of the Gallagher Bluedorn, said in a news release. The proposed space will provide guests with a place to gather with friends for drinks or a light dinner before the show and a place to linger over coffee after the show. The Marquee Lounge will also serve as a private classroom for the center's Kaleidoscope participants to meet and interact with authors and actors. Each year, the Gallagher Bluedorn provides opportunity for upwards of 40,000 preschool through 12th grade students to experience a wide range of performing arts at a $1 per child cost. Quote, the Kaleidoscope series has allowed the Gallagher Bluedorn to serve underserved rural communities of eastern Iowa, Kerrigan said. Our younger audience members can gather in the new lounge space to discuss, think, laugh, and really dig into the meaning of performance. Kaleidoscope participants will be provided with a unique opportunity to learn firsthand about theater and connect with performers. Quote, we hope this investment in Cedar Valley will enhance the experience of the patrons of the Gallagher Bluedorn Performing Arts Center and increase not only usage of the facility, but increase the number of individuals who are able to enjoy what the Gallagher Bluedorn has to offer, Hoffman said. Quote, this gift would have resonated with Pauline, and she would have been proud to know the number of students that will benefit, unquote. Other announced gifts for the renovation and expansion project include $1 million from the Gallagher Family Foundation and $200,000 from Cecilia and Jim Mudd Sr. Construction on the project is slated to begin in the summer of 2022. The gifts were made to the University of Northern Iowa through the UNI Foundation. Learn more about it at foundation.uni.edu. Turning the page now to the entertainment section, F9 puts Charge back into movie theaters with a $70 million opening. The story is filed by Andrew Dalton of the Associated Press. The story opens with a photograph taken from the movie showing Vin Diesel left and Michelle Rodriguez, and they're shown in a scene from F9 The Fast Saga, Los Angeles. In the strongest sign yet that life is left in movie theaters, F9 sped to a box office take of $70 million in its first weekend, the biggest opening for a film since the pandemic began, according to studio estimates Sunday. The ninth installment in the Fast and Furious franchise, starring franchise regulars Vin Diesel and Michelle Rodriguez, opened only in theaters and had the widest release of any movie since the start of the coronavirus crisis. The domestic total for Universal Pictures' F9 topped the previous pandemic best of $48.4 million for A Quiet Place Part II 4 weeks ago. It was the biggest opening of any film since Star Wars: The Rise of Skywalker in December 2019. Quote, "We couldn't be more gratified to see the audience embraced the Fast family and came out to see F9 in tremendous numbers," said Jim Orr, head of distribution for Universal. Quote, "The debut this weekend has really ignited the domestic box office and set it on a tremendous path for the rest of the year." Quote, "A Quiet Place 2 came in a very distant second with $6.2 million, but it has now earned $136.4 million since its release. The Hitman's Wife's Bodyguard brought in $4.88 million in the third spot. F9, whose release was delayed several times, looks to have landed on just the right weekend to open in North America. It seemed to be a fitting film for the industry movement, with young audiences eager to be in theaters for a movie that emphasizes a loud, action-packed, immersive experience. Quote, "It's the perfect intersection of growing consumer confidence and vaccinations in North America, with movies that have already been released creating momentum," said Paul Dergarabedian, the senior media analyst for Comscore. Quote, "I don't think you could have imagined a better scenario for the industry, with a few speed bumps in there, with Furious 9 being really the first summer blockbuster in 2 years. F9 debuted internationally on May 19th and has now grossed more than $400 million globally. Universal eschewed the hybrid approach of combining theatrical and streaming releases, as Disney did earlier in the year with Cruella, and Warner Brothers did with Godzilla vs. Kong. It also came after most major theater chains have significantly loosened restrictions on capacity and masking. The trends suggest that Hollywood might have something resembling a regular summer movie season, albeit one that starts months late and won't be setting any industry records. Releases in the coming weeks include Disney and Marvel's Black Widow and Warner Brothers' The Suicide Squad. Studios are using a variety of hybrid release plans. While the time movies spend between theaters and streaming has shrunk, probably permanently, there is an increasing emphasis back on the big screen. Quote, "It's a delayed start to a summer that's been a long time coming. To have late June be ostensibly the start of summer is unusual, but better late than never," Dergarabedian said. Quote, "A big 4th of July weekend is coming up, with virtually every genre represented, and a week later we have Black Widow, so we're on the road to recovery," unquote. $329,000 gift received by Waterloo Schools Foundation from Trust of Longtime Educators. This story is filed by Andrew Wind. Waterloo, a pair of longtime educators, has given a $329,000 legacy gift to the Waterloo Schools Foundation, the largest amount received from community members in its 11-year history. The gift, arranged by the late Eleanor Kitchum, will establish a fund for scholarship dollars to be used for students pursuing careers in education. Eleanor died May 4, 2020, at age 94. Her husband, Kenneth, died on January 19, 2008, at the age of 81. Quote, "We're incredibly grateful and honored that this donation from the Ketchum Trust will allow the foundation to continue supporting public education in Waterloo by investing in our future teachers and leaders," Kristen Stanford, president of the foundation's board of directors, said in a news release, quote, "This gift is a wonderful way to remember the devotion of both Kenneth and Eleanor to Waterloo Public Schools," unquote. Eleanor worked for Waterloo Community Schools for more than 40 years, teaching English at East and Central High Schools. She also was a member of the American Association of University Women and served as president of the Waterloo branch. She and Kenneth were married for 58 years before his death. He taught and coached in Waterloo schools for 16 years and served as a school administrator for 22 years. Their son, Thomas, was also employed by the district until he died on March 7, 2012. In a news release, the foundation said it is, quote, "grateful to continue the legacy of the Ketchums and continue to support the 11,000-plus teachers and students in the Waterloo Community School District," unquote. The Ketchums' gift is slightly larger than two other donations received in the past 3 years. Dorothy Powell gave $312,813 to the foundation in September 2019, about a year after her death. The Otto Scholz Foundation gave a $300,000 donation to the organization in the spring of 2018. The Waterloo Schools Foundation started in 2010 as an independent nonprofit that supports, enhances, and promotes excellent education opportunities in the district. To learn how to support the foundation through legacy giving, contact Hannah Luce at 319-939-9550 or h.luce@wcsfoundation.org. And now in the sixth installment of the series 8 over 80, Lane Nichols is leading lady in Cedar Falls. Longtime educator, volunteer, thrives in service to community. This story was filed by Holly Hudson of the Courier. Cedar Falls. Leanne Nichols has an affinity for downtown Cedar Falls, and with good reason. Quote, "Until I was 12, I lived at the Black Hawk Hotel," she said. "My father owned the hotel, and my grandfather owned the restaurant next to it, so I grew up down there. I saw just about every movie the theater showed. I had a lot of freedom within the hotel." Theater has always been a passion for Nichols. "We had a wonderful drama department in high school," she said. In college, Nichols studied under both Hazel Strayer and Stanley Wood. Their namesake Strayer Wood Theater houses the University of Northern Iowa's Department of Theater's production program. Nichols had a double major, theater and education. Her first teaching job was in Dyke. She was there for 2 years before taking time off to care for her family. She and her husband, Bud, who married while in college, raised 3 children. She then went back to work part-time for the Cedar Falls Community Schools and would end up teaching at Holmes Junior High School for 28 years. Quote, "I loved it," she said. "I was very fortunate in being the Cedar Falls system. The principals were always so supportive and encouraging. First Norm Swanson and then Lee Mickey. I loved all the extracurricular activities I was able to develop. It was a good time to be a teacher." Quote, "I run across former students all the time. I love to hear what they're doing," unquote. Larry Cardamon, who nominated Nichols for 8 over 80 recognition, wrote, quote, "I have only known Leanne Nichols since 2007, but continue to be in awe of her strength, energy, and open-heartedness when it comes to public service. There is no one in the Cedar Valley who more exemplifies the concept of offering service to the community than Leanne," unquote. Nichols' community involvement goes back decades. Quote, "We were involved in civil rights in the 1960s, women's issues in the 70s, then politics," she said. Bud ran for state representative in 2002. In 1977, Nichols and another woman were approached to revive community theater in Cedar Falls. "There had been one, but it was closed many years before," she said. "We were given $500 to start it. The people on the board thought we were crazy," unquote. The group has housed at Holmes Junior High School and put on its first show in February 1978, The Curious Savage. After 16 years, the Cedar Falls Community Theater was offered the Regent Theater in downtown Cedar Falls. The building, originally the Cotton Theater, was built in 1910 as a performance hall. Its name was changed to the Regent Theater in 1918, and Merle Blair bought it in 1921. Jean Blair managed the theater until 1991, when it was gifted to the Cedar Falls Community Theater. Quote, "We knew taking it over, it would have to be totally restored and renovated," Nichols said. "It was a movie theater, and we had to transform it back into a legitimate theater. And we still had 2 years of movies we were contracted to show," unquote. A fundraising effort led by Nichols' father, Ivor Christofferson, and former local student and actor Annabeth Gish, raised $1.2 million to refurbish the theater. In June 1994, the name was changed to the Auster Regent Theater. Quote, "We had three goals with the theater project," said Nichols, who was one of three co-chairs for the fundraising committee. Quote, "We wanted to bring a historical building back to itself, bring economic growth to the downtown and to Cedar Falls, and establish a cultural center. I think we delivered on all those promises. Recently, the theater underwent some updates while closed due to the pandemic." Quote, "That was one positive to come from COVID," Nichols said. "We had the time to do it. We have new carpet, new tile, new curtain." Nichols currently serves as the CFCT Artistic Coordinator and Director. She has written, built costumes, directed, and acted in countless productions. Nichols also is active in her church, St. Luke's Episcopal. Quote, "I grew up in that church," she said. "I've been attending there for, 85 years? Over all these years, I've been a Sunday school teacher, a summer Bible school teacher. I help with any projects I can. In the mid-80s, I felt called to an ordained ministry. Deacons are ordained in the Episcopal Church, the same as Catholics, but Catholic Church won't ordain women. So I studied for 7 years and was ordained. We do visitation of the sick and shut-ins. We do some liturgical things during the service. It's been very rewarding," unquote. Nichols also is involved with IRIS, the Iowa Radio Information Service for the Blind. Quote, "They have closed down due to the pandemic, but we would go to UNI and read the newspaper. There were two of us. We would read the local articles. I've been doing that for 7 or 8 years now," unquote. Additionally, Nichols volunteers at Mercy One, formerly Satori Memorial Hospital, in Cedar Falls. The Cedar Falls Historical Society, the Cedar Falls Public Library, and Meals on Wheels. The Nichols family was active with Youth for Understanding, hosting foreign exchange students in their home. Quote, "We hosted 9 kids, Nichols said. We were area representatives for Northeast Iowa. Bud was also the counselor for the exchange students at Cedar Falls High School. In 2015, Nichols was honored with the Cedar Falls Community Foundation's Peter Belendi Community Builder Award. The award goes to people who have made voluntary community contributions that have enhanced, improved, or positively affected the overall quality of life in Cedar Falls. Quote, "Peter Melendi was someone my dad had admired throughout his life. He was an early father of Cedar Falls. I remember during the bicentennial, my dad gave a speech at Overman Park about Melendi." Quote, "Winning the award was a surprise, but it was very gratifying," unquote. You are listening to the reading of the Waterloo Cedar Falls for Monday, June 28th on IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind. There are no obituaries in the paper today, so let's turn to the sports page. In women's golf, Woe Nelly, a major title for COTA and number one world ranking. Stories filed by Doug Ferguson of the Associated Press. And it begins with a photograph of Nelly Korda holding up a giant trophy. Johns Creek, Georgia. First came the tears when Nelly Korda hugged her older sister and didn't want to let go. That was followed by the spray of champagne on the 18th green to celebrate a day that will be hard for her to top, even at age 22. With one round, she became a major champion for the first time and reached number one in the world. Quote, "Is this week even real?" Korda said. It's amazing. Just like her performance Sunday in the KPMG Women's PGA Championship, Korda powered her way to a pair of eagles that wore down Lizette Salas at Atlanta Athletic Club and put an American atop the world ranking for the first time in 7 years. Korda nearly holed out with a 7-wood from 243 yards for a tap-in eagle. She seized control by using her length from that graceful swing, leaving her a 6-iron to the par 5 12th hole that narrowly cleared the water and set up an 8-foot eagle putt. The final stroke was a 15-foot par putt for a 4-under-68 and a 3-shot victory over Salas. Quote, the past few days, the battle with Lizette has been a lot of fun. It's been stressful. I think it's had everything, Korda said, but I just can't believe it. I'm still in shock, unquote. At 19-under-269, she tied the women's PGA record to par last, matched by NB Park at Winchester County Club in 2015. Korda won for the second straight week, her third LPGA title this year, and it was enough to become the first American at number one in the women's world ranking since Stacy Lewis in 2014. Jin Young Ko had held the number one spot for nearly 2 years. Her only mistake came when it didn't matter. Korda seized control with a 6-iron she caught heavy enough to worry it might not clear the pond on the par 5 12th and was relieved when it rolled out to 8 feet for eagle. That turned into a 3-shot swing when Salas, who spent the weekend hitting hybrids on holes that Korda had short irons, hit wedge over the green into a bunker and made bogey. Quote, that was my favorite wedge, too, Salas said. The good thing is, I was committed to that shot. The wind is pretty swirly. Maybe a little drop kick. I don't know. Got a few extra yards out of it. Korda made an 18-foot birdie putt on number 14 to stretch her lead to 5 shots with 4 holes to play, only to end 49 consecutive holes without a bogey by hitting into the water on the par 3 15th. For a double bogey, but she steadied herself with a pair of pars and played it conservatively down the par 5, closing hole over water. Korda's older sister, Jessica, was among the first to embrace her on the 18th green as the emotions began to emerge. Jessica finished much earlier. They shared a hug as Nellie was teeing off and Jessica was making the turn, though the older sibling had another reason to celebrate. She easily held down the 4th American spot for the Olympics in Japan. It was a big celebration for one of the top sporting families in the world. The Korda sisters each have 6 LPGA victories. Their younger brother, Sebastian, is at Wimbledon this week as the 50th ranked player in men's tennis and has a chance to join them in Tokyo for the Olympics. Their father is Peter Korda, who won the Australian Open in tennis in 1998. Quote, you don't realize it until someone really talks about it because we're always so in the zone, Korda said of the family's success. Quote, we're always just striving to achieve more and for our family just to back each other through every situation. It's so surreal, unquote. Salas, who felt a burden lifted this week when she opened up about emotional struggles exposed during the COVID-19 pandemic, closed with a 71 and made Korda work for it. They started the final round tied for the lead, 5 clear of anyone else, and it was up for grabs until the pivotal 12th hole. Korda took the lead for good with a birdie on the 3rd hole. Even after the eagle on the 5th, Salas bounced back with a tee shot on the reachable par 4 6th that set up birdie to close the gap to 1 shot. But it all turned so quickly. Salas had a 15-foot birdie putt on the 10th to tie for the lead. 2 holes later, she was 4 shots behind against a player who was not about to let Salas back in the game. Quote, she played great, and there's nothing I could have done differently to change her game plan, and that says a lot about her, Salas said. Quote, I'm just lucky she's on the American side for that Solheim Cup. Korda is the first American to win a major since Angela Stanford 3 years ago in the Evian, and it extended a big year for the U.S. women's golf. Americans have won 6 times on the LPGA Tour this season. South Korea and Thailand are next with 2 apiece. Now in NASCAR, clutch performance, Kyle Busch ends Hendrick win streak, filed by Dan Gelston of the Associated Press, and begins with a photograph of Kyle Busch holding his trophy overhead after winning the NASCAR Cup Series race Sunday at Pocono Raceway in Long Pond, Pennsylvania. Kyle Busch had a Joe Gibbs Racing team member slide in his Toyota through the window, and he tried to figure out how to mend a fried stick shifter welded in fourth gear. It's rare a NASCAR driver has a passenger in the car, so Busch made small talk on the pit stop with car chief Nate Bellows. "Wait," Busch said, "you don't want to go with me?" The Toyota never really did get fixed. There were 115 miles to the Pocono finish. Busch had a fried clutch, only one gear, and had to rush his car chief out of the car. But he had a full tank of gas, so he hit it. Busch came through in the clutch, even though he raced without one, and busted Hendrick's Motorsports winning streak and denied the organization a shot at NASCAR history when he raced to his second victory of the season on Sunday. Quote, "Put as much gas in it as we can, pack that thing full, and we're going to run it out the rest of the day," Busch said. Busch stretched his fuel in his broken Toyota and outlasted late leaders William Byron and JGR teammate Denny Hamlin as they saw their shot at the checkered flag disappear over the final few laps when they ran out of gas. Quote, "Sometimes these races aren't always won by the fastest car," Busch said. "Sometimes they're won by a car that could use a push to victory lane." Quote, "We're going down the front straightaway, and I'm like, damn, I wish I could clutch it," Busch said. "I didn't have one. I probably could have done a better job saving fuel, but I was just lifting off the gas instead of being able to clutch it." Busch was on the brink of snapping Hendrick's winning streak with a runner-up finish to Alec Bowman in Saturday's Pocono Twin Bill opener. He couldn't get the help he needed Saturday with the right push, but he got the critical pit road assist Sunday and then drove the final 46 laps on the 2.5-mile oval, knowing another stop in the pits would end his race. Quote, "It took some brute force to hold that thing back, to hold it in," Busch said. Busch raced without care early and sang a few bars of Fly Like an Eagle over the radio. His 59th career Cup victory will go down as one of Busch's greatest hits. NASCAR's career wins leader in all series has 100 in the Xfinity and 61 in trucks. Kyle Larson, whose blown tire on the last lap cost him a win Saturday, was second for Hendrick Motorsports. Hendrick had won 6 straight Cup races, capped by Bowman's 3rd win over his last 10 races. Hendrick was trying to become the first team since NASCAR's modern era began in 1972 to win 7 straight races. Bowman started the streak in May at Dover, and Chase Elliott followed the next week at Texas. Larson then ripped off 3 straight points victories at Charlotte, Sonoma, and last week at Nashville, and squeezed in the $1 million All-Star race for 4 wins total, all while Hendrick Motorsports became the winningest organization in NASCAR history. Brad Keselowski was 3rd, Kevin Harvick 4th, and Bubba Wallace was 5th in his best finish of the season for Michael Jordan's 231X team. Hamlin faded to 14th. Quote, "Fuel mileage got us the last 2 weeks," Hamlin said. "We can't see the checkered right now," unquote. The checkered flag went to Busch in a fortuitous way, thanks to the transmission woes that forced him to pit and top off his tank. Quote, "We would have never been in that position if we didn't have the trans stuck," Busch said. "We got all we could get out of it with everything that was going on," unquote. Now let's turn back to the Cedar Valley section and pick up some more local news. In government and politics, with a challenger already announced, Frank Dara says he'll run for re-election. Story filed by Amy Rivers. and begins with a photograph of Frank Dara. Cedar Falls. Frank Dara is gearing up for his fifth campaign for city council, but it'll be the first time he'll have a challenger. Dara, 73, announced last week he'll run for a fifth four-year term as the Ward 5 representative on the council after pondering whether four terms was long enough, saying he didn't, quote, want to wear out his welcome, unquote. But he said he thinks his institutional knowledge, 16 years under his belt on the council and 38 in city government, including his service on the planning and zoning in parks and recreation commissions, is a good reason to reelect him. Quote, I think that's really important right now that we have people on the council who have history, who understand how the process works, who understand the role, and understand the relationship between elected officials and staff, Dara said in an interview with The Courier. Quote, I think some of what we've experienced over the last couple of years is people who don't appreciate those relationships. Dara was first elected to his post in 2005 after urging from community members to run against Stan Smith. He's the second longest-serving member on the council after ward member Susan DeBurr, elected 2 years earlier. But after his initial election, Dara has run unopposed each time. Quote, I want to believe it's because people are satisfied with what I've done, how I've done it, and the direction in the city is going, Dara said. That doesn't mean Dara hasn't faced competition. In 2011, he made a run for then-Mayor John Cruz's job. Despite raising more money than Cruz, Dara couldn't overcome the longtime mayor's popularity, garnering just 40% of the vote, though he continued to serve on the council. Now, Dara will resurrect his campaign committee 10 years later to run against newcomer and retired Waterloo police officer Rob Michael, an anti-PSO candidate who announced he would challenge Dara in May. Quote, I'm running because I care about the city and want to keep moving in a positive direction, Dara said, and if anyone wants to help, I need a chairperson. Dara has voted multiple times to affirm the city's move to a public safety model of police and fire protection. Quote, the town has not burned down. We've saved a lot of money. I think it's a very effective, professional group of officers, Dara said. But the anti-PSO group of candidates, including T.J. Frayne and Gil Schultz, who is running for Mark Miller's seat after Miller announced he wouldn't seek a third term, also worries Dara. Anti-PSO sentiment vaulted council members Dave Sires and Simon Harding into office in 2019, and a majority may be within reach this election, starting the process of unwinding the combined department, which the city has said could cost taxpayers $2 million a year. Quote, to me, it totally depends on this next election, Dara said. The other big issue is the idea the city administrator has too much power at the expense of elected full-time mayor. Dara contends it's a misunderstanding based on overlapping but separate discussions about switching the city from full-time to part-time mayor, as well as cleaning up city code where mayoral and administrator duties overlapped. Quote, that left the perception that the administrator was trying to take control of the city, and that couldn't be further from the truth, Dara said. Quote, I just regret that we've gotten to this point that there's a level of distrust, unquote. It was Dara's suggestion in February to form a task force addressing racial equity issues in the city. Now its chair, he said he believed the Cedar Valley had to face up to the issue of being named one of the worst places in the nation for black people to live by investment website 24/7 Wall Street. Quote, we're just starting the conversation, Dara said. Quote, if we can survive that and take small steps somewhere along the line, we'll be more inclusive, more diversive. A self-described big-picture thinker who supported recent visioning plans, Dara said voters should look at Cedar Falls as a whole, not just the PSO issue, before casting their vote in November. Quote, very few people look at Cedar Falls and say anything other than, that's a pretty cool town. And it didn't just happen, Dara said. If we just throw the baby out with the bathwater, because we're mad about one thing, and by God we're going to turn that around, no matter how much it costs, how divisive it is, You can't fix that, and I want to be there to defend this if I have to, unquote. Ruling limits safety-based drug testing at Iowa warehouses. Story filed by Ryan Foley of the Associated Press, Iowa City. The Iowa Supreme Court ruled Friday that employers cannot subject all warehouse employees to random drug testing by designating them as having, quote, safety-sensitive jobs. In its 4-3 ruling, the court ruled that companies may consider the specific duties of each worker when designing safety-based drug testing programs and not just where they work. The majority rejected an argument from the state's largest business association that courts should not second-guess determinations made by employers on which jobs are more dangerous than others. The decision interpreted a 1998 Iowa law that regulates how employers can conduct unannounced testing for drugs and alcohol in workplaces. One option under the law that is popular with employers is to test only those workers who are in safety-sensitive jobs in which an accident could cause death, serious injury, or damage. The case before the court involved a determination by the gas station chain Casey's General Stores that all workers at its Ankeny distribution warehouse were safety-sensitive employees. The company implemented random drug testing for them in 2016, citing concerns about widespread drug use. Three employees who tested positive for either marijuana or amphetamines were fired, and a fourth who failed to provide an adequate urine sample was let go. All four sued the company, raising a variety of concerns about how the drug testing program was conducted. In a 4-3 decision, justices ruled that two of the employees were not in safety-sensitive jobs and therefore should not have been subject to testing under the Casey's program. Their jobs involved light-duty work, counting cigarette boxes in a secure, fenced-in area known as the cage. Justices reinstated a trial court's ruling that the two employees were entitled to monetary damages for lost pay, rejecting the Casey's argument that their jobs were in a dangerous environment due to the use of heavy equipment elsewhere in the warehouse. Allowing employers to designate which workers have safety-sensitive positions without regard to job functions would allow them to unfairly target certain people for testing, an outcome in the 1998 law intended to avoid, Justice Dana Oxley wrote. Quote, while we do not disagree that employers likely know the best which of their positions are safety-sensitive, Casey's improperly focused on the environment in which a job is performed rather than the job functions in making that determination, she wrote. The court rejected challenges brought by the other two employees who operated forklifts and lifted heavy objects and therefore were in safety-sensitive jobs. In a dissent, Justice Matthew McDermott wrote that the majority ventures into the role of HR director for Casey's General Stores. He said there was no grounds to overturn the company's determination on whom to test, saying any impaired employees in a warehouse setting pose risks to themselves and others. Quote, employers in Iowa might be surprised to find that they're setting themselves up for liability by being overly vigorous in designating warehouse positions as safety-sensitive in their efforts to ensure a drug-free workplace, he wrote. In a companion case Friday, justices sided with a technician at a Des Moines car dealership who was fired after testing positive for methamphetamine in 2017. Under the law, companies are required to inform fired workers that they have the right to obtain a test to confirm the positive sample at their own expense. The dealership did not comply with the law because its notice failed to tell him how much a retest would cost, depriving him of the ability to make an informed decision, Oxley wrote for a unanimous court. The case was sent back to a lower court to consider an award for lost pay. The next story is filed by James Lynch of the Courier. Former Cedar Rapids teacher joins Iowa Democratic Hall of Fame. Cedar Rapids, political activism is both a vocation and an avocation for Amy Adams. The former Cedar Rapids teacher works by day as an organizer for Progress Iowa, a multi-issue advocacy group, and Iowa Citizen Action Network. She also was a co-founder of the Indivisible Iowa Group in Cedar Rapids. Adams's activism is driven by personal experience and the challenges she's witnessed others facing, including relocating to her hometown of St. Lucas, about 85 miles north of Cedar Rapids, to care for her late father. Her goal is, quote, to make the world a more just place for the folks that I see impacted by some of these bad pieces of legislation and just some of the red tape issues that don't make sense to seniors and hardworking Iowans, Adams said. Quote, the system is sometimes harder than what it needs to be, unquote. Adams's leadership in the Democratic Party and in allied organizations, quote, is a great model of what activism really is and putting your heart and your voice into action, First District Democratic Central Committee Chairwoman Catherine Crist of Cedar Rapids said. For her efforts, Adams was inducted into the Iowa Democratic Party Hall of Fame earlier this month. Other inductees were retired 2nd District U.S. Representative Dave Loebsack, former State Senator Tom Courtney, party leaders and activists Paula Martinez, Diane LaRude Chuba, and Athena Gilbreth, and rising star Alma Puga. Adams, 46, who taught overseas for 5 years and then high school English for 15 years in Cedar Rapids, said the 2016 election and the Republican-controlled Iowa legislature's gutting of Chapter 20, the state public employee collective bargaining law, was the catalyst for kicking her activism into higher gear. As a member of the Iowa State Education Association and the local negotiating team, she understood the importance of bargaining rights to the unions and what the loss of topics to be negotiated meant to members. Quote, it was very personal to me because I saw how that would impact myself, obviously, but also my colleagues, my co-workers, Adams said. Quote, so I think at the heart of what got me organizing or involved was just seeing the impact that some of this concerning legislation would have on my job and the folks that I cared about. Another contributing factor was her experience providing palliative care for her father. Although he had private insurance, the high cost of health care presented challenges. He died 2 months before he could have been eligible for Medicare and Social Security, Adams says. It troubled her that someone could work his entire life and not be able to access those benefits when he needed them. Much of her work is just reaching out to folks and helping them be advocates for themselves, to give them a platform to be able to tell their story, Adams said. Adams has remained active in the Democratic Party politics as secretary of the Fayette Democratic Party and a delegate to the 1st Congressional District Democratic Central Committee. She's also a volunteer board member for Indivisible Iowa, representing the 1st District. She and her husband, Ben Henson, a nurse, live on an acreage at St. Lucas where they were raising their 3 children while dabbling in beekeeping and restoring a natural prairie habitat. On the commentary page, we have a column by Aaron Murphy titled, Iowa Still Politically Purple in One Area. The political divide in Iowa has been shrinking in recent election cycles, and the state is becoming far more red than blue. But Iowa remains politically purple in at least one area, and that makes it an outlier across the country, its split of Democrats and Republicans holding statewide office. Iowa is one of just 4 states in the country with Democrats and Republicans each holding at least 2 statewide elected offices, according to research by Sabato's Crystal Ball of University of Virginia's Center for Politics. Like everything else in our politically polarized climate, unified party control of statewide elected offices is expanding. According to the Crystal Ball's research, in 34 states, one party controls all statewide offices, and in another 12 states, one party controls all but 1 statewide office. Only Iowa, Arizona, North Carolina, and Washington have a genuine mix of Democratic and Republican statewide office holders. Iowa has Republican Governor Kim Reynolds, Secretary of State Paul Pate, and Secretary of Agriculture Mike Nag, Attorney General Tom Miller, State Auditor Rob Sand, and State Treasurer Mike Fitzgerald, are Democrats. In describing each state's political climate, the crystal ball wrote that Iowa, quote, has a history as a swing state, although less so today on the presidential level. Iowa went for Democrat Barack Obama in 2008 and 2012, then Republican Donald Trump in 2016 and 2020. Beyond that swing of political pendulum, Iowa's congressional delegation has gone from a political shift that lasted for roughly a half century to mostly Republican domination since 2014. Republicans have held both U.S. Senate seats since 2014 and the governor's office for more than a decade. All of this has led many political analysts to believe Iowa is headed toward, if it hasn't already arrived, at red state status. Those statewide, state-level offices remain the outlier. Democrats Miller and Fitzgerald are longtime incumbents, each of whom is the longest-serving official in his respective position in U.S. history. Miller's and Fitzgerald's longtime tenure gives Democrats two fairly automatic wins every 4 years. The two rarely face a serious electoral challenge. Sand added to the Democrats' hold on statewide offices in 2018 when he defeated Republican incumbent Mary Mosaman. The state auditor's race is not typically one in which voters pay much attention, and Sand, in 2018, swooped in with a well-funded and politically smart campaign. If Sand runs for re-election, he's also considering a run for governor. He would be difficult to unseat. Likewise, Republicans are mostly on solid ground in the statewide offices they control. It's difficult to envision a Democrat winning the agricultural secretary's race anytime soon, even though the party did it in the 2000s with Patty Judge. And Republicans have held the Secretary of State's office since 2010. Then there's the governor's office. The transition from Branstad to Reynolds, his former lieutenant, has proved smooth thus far for Republicans, but this may be the Democrats' best opportunity to flip a statewide seat. In 2018, Reynolds, in her first election, won by less than 3 percentage points. And that does it for today's reading of the Waterloo Cedar Falls The Courier for Monday, June 28th. I'm your reader, Bob Young. You can access a recording of today's reading on our website, iowaradioreading.org, at any time, and you may wish to stay tuned to the reading of the Dubuque Telegraph Herald, which follows shortly. Thanks so much for being with us and listening today.